Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 5th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the Siouxlands 5-day forecast, and today is going to be cloudy and mild with a high of 57 and a low of 25. Wednesday will also be mild with clouds and sun with a high of 59 and a low of 31. Thursday will have occasional rain with a high of 53 and a low of 32. Friday will be cooler with a little rain in the morning and with a high of 46 and a low of 23. And Saturday will be plenty of sunshine with a high of 49 and a low of 24. Today's mini editorial is written by William Burroughs of Sioux City, and William writes, I think Caitlin Clark should break a glass ceiling and hold out for the NBA draft because she will be grossly underpaid in the WNBA. And again, this was written by William Burroughs of Sioux City. Our first story today is about the Sioux City School District's Teacher of the Year. And this was written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. Riverside Elementary teacher Chris McCarthy's ability to turn lemons into lemonade is one reason she was named the Sioux City Community School District's Teacher of the Year on Monday. The saying, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade, stands out when I think about the teacher and the person Chris is, said a fellow Riverside teacher. McCarthy is a special education teacher at Riverside. She has 18 years of teaching experience and has been with the district since 2012. On Monday, the district held an assembly at Riverside to announce her award. Chris McCarthy, she is one of our very, very best teachers, and we love her so much and we're so proud of her. I can't say enough good things about how much she means to our school and the difference she makes in so many students' lives, said Kathy Thode, principal of Riverside Elementary. McCarthy said she was humbled by the award and said it was more of an honor for the whole school. She said, everybody is so integral to everybody else in what we do, and we collaborate, we work as a team, we are in constant contact with each other for the needs of all our kids. I honestly feel like not one teacher here would be the success they are without everybody else in the building. Each year, district schools are asked to nominate individuals for Building Teacher of the Year. Director of Communications Leslie Haying said normally one nomination form is submitted for a teacher, but for McCarthy, an entire packet of recommendation letters were submitted. A fellow teacher at Riverside said she has faced many personal things, but she chooses to see the joy and light through it all. Chris is rarely gone from work, which she tells us is her saving grace. Little does she know, she's a saving grace for us all at Riverside. McCarthy lives with a diagnosis of terminal stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. She said continuing to work at Riverside is what gets her up in the morning and gives her purpose. She said these kids and the other teachers and the staff in this building are so important and they've been incredibly supportive. I could not make this journey without them. Superintendent Rod Erlingwine said McCarthy stood out because of her commitment to go above and beyond for her students and team members on a daily basis. McCarthy's information will be submitted to the Iowa Department of Education for consideration as the state's Teacher of the Year representative. The Sioux City Education Association and the district choose the Teacher of the Year from teachers nominated from all of the schools. The teachers nominated this year: Alicia Jelkin, North High School; Aubra Garrett, Nodland Elementary School; Becky Ranchetto, Irving Dual Language Elementary School; Carla Green, Leeds Elementary School; Christina Bliven, Morningside STEM Elementary School; Deb Condon, Unity Elementary School; Derek Simonson, Perry Creek Elementary School; Betsy Bodker, West High School; Haley Jansen, Liberty Elementary School; Jamie Zizda, East High School; Jennifer Bruning, East Middle School; Jennifer Petty, Clark Early Childhood Center; Jill Risdahl, Sioux City Career Academy; Jonathan Trainer, North Middle School; Julie Betts, Hunt A Plus Arts Elementary School; Kate Vanderloo, Spalding Park Environmental Science Elementary School; Richard Wilshire, West Middle School; Sarah Princeton Bryant Elementary School; Sue Newton, Luce Hills Community Programming Elementary School. Our next story is from the Sioux City Council meeting. Council awards $1.8 million pedestrian bridge contract. The Sioux City Council, by approving its consent agenda on Monday, awarded a $1.8 million contract to a Lincoln, Nebraska construction company for the second phase of the Big Sioux Pedestrian Bridge Crossing Project. The bridge, which is expected to be completed in the fall, will be located just north of Interstate 29 and built over the Big Sioux River, linking Sioux City and the Dakota Dunes Trail systems. The project includes the construction of a pre-engineered steel truss pedestrian bridge, grading, storm sewer, retaining wall construction, and PCC paving for the 10-foot-wide trail. The city is managing the joint project, with a total construction budget of $2.6 million. The project is being funded through a combination of sources, including the Dakota Dunes CID, Sioux City General Obligation Bonds, and Destination Iowa grant funding. A total of $1.4 million of the cost of the bridge is being covered by private contributions. Sioux City Parks and Recreation Director Matt Salvatore told the council that this project is the result of a lot of generosity and people from both sides of the state. So we're very fortunate to have people that are supporting quality of life projects. The project, which was bid on February 13th, received three bids. All of those bids came in above the city engineer's estimate of $1,591,021. K2 Real Estate Development, LLC of Lincoln submitted the low bid of $1,875,001.05. In 2022, the Siouxland Trails Network was awarded a $7 million tourism grant from the state of Iowa to expedite the development of a network of recreational trails in Metro Sioux City. The Big Sioux Pedestrian Bridge was one of five projects listed on the city's Destination Iowa grant funding application. The council also approved a First Amendment to a 28E agreement between the city and Dakota Dunes Community Improvement District, the CID, for the project. The amendment adds language which allows the agreement to be terminated by a written agreement approved by both parties. Salvatore previously told the Journal the amendment is a technicality required by the Iowa Secretary of State. After the agreement was approved locally, he said, it went to the state for approval. The state came back with the addition of language to allow either side to get out of the agreement. The 28E agreement sets forth the responsibilities of the city and the Dakota Dunes CID, as well as each party's share of the construction expenses. Under the agreement, which both parties entered into on June 5, 2023, the city of Sioux City is responsible for the cost of the bridge's design and inspection. The city also supervises the project's bidding and construction administration and has the authority to sell the naming rights of the bridge and trail. Dakota Dunes participates financially in the bridge's construction and the amount not to exceed $140,000. Sioux City insures the bridge, and Dakota Dunes is responsible for reimbursing half of the premium and half of any deductible for any claims that arise. Each jurisdiction will own the portion of the bridge that exists within its corporate boundary. Sioux City is responsible for all bridge maintenance, while Dakota Dunes agrees to pay $1,000 annually toward bridge maintenance. Dakota Dunes also pays 25% of the total of any mutually agreed capital improvement projects. And this article was written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. MERD taking applicants for Target Grant Program. The Missouri River Historical Development, or MERD, is now taking applications for its yearly Target Grant Program. The application period is through the month of March, and a total of $500,000 will be up for grabs. According to MERD, recipients of the grants will be named during an award ceremony on May 23rd. The MERD Target Grant is a competitive grant opportunity that provides applicants up to $25,000 for 1 year to support a variety of local organizations and is designed to address short-term projects or capacity-building items, MERD Executive Director David Gleiser said in a release. Successful applicants can receive up to $25,000 for 1 year, and their projects need to be in one of five areas: economic development, community improvement, tourism, health and human services, civic, public, patriotic, charitable, religious, leisure, culture, historical, education, Blaiser said. Local governments, tax-exempt organizations, and educational institutions in the Iowa counties of Cherokee, Crawford, Ida, Monona, Plymouth, and Woodbury are all able to apply, as are those in Union County, South Dakota, and Dakota County, Nebraska. Wayne State holds World Speech Day. Wayne State College is holding an event later this month to try and show students and community members their voices matter. From 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. March 15th at the Hofbauer Plaza, the school is holding a World Speech Day event, which will be open to high school and college students as well as area residents. Participants are encouraged to speak freely on any topic. Engaging activities include spin the wheel of ideas and pin your ideas to the wall, the college said in a release. This great learning opportunity features food, prizes, activities, and cool Wayne State College swag. World Speech Day was launched in 2015 by Simon Gibson at the Athens Democracy Forum, according to the World Speech Day website. Our mission is to celebrate speeches and speechmaking through live public events across the globe. We celebrate the role of speeches to bring communities together and, above all, to share ideas, the non-for-profit organization said. WCHS to host Food is Medicine Month, a Winnebago. The Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System, or WCHS, is taking part in National Nutrition Month with a public event focused on Indigenous food. Food is Medicine, which is the name of the presentation, will include door prizes, a healthy meal, and an educational component. The public event is set for 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. March 6 at the Whirling Thunder Wellness Center Gym at 205 Bluff Street in Winnebago. Nutrition education is essential in the Winnebago community as a preventive health resource. This presentation will demonstrate how to make simple yet healthy Indigenous food for people on the go, the Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System said in a release. The WCHS Wa'aipinagu program will involve a collaboration between Executive Chef Elena Terry and Chef Apprentice Ann Thundercloud. Iowa House ratchets up fentanyl death penalty. Iowa House Republicans passed a bill that would make a person eligible for a first-degree murder charge for selling or providing another person with fentanyl that results in their death. A person who is convicted of first-degree murder under the bill would receive life in prison without the possibility of parole. The bill, House File 2576, passed the House 86-12. It is now eligible for consideration in the Senate. The Republicans said the bill was necessary to help address historically high overdose deaths from fentanyl and the trafficking of the drug in Iowa. Some Democrats, though, warned the bill could implicate teenagers and people who share a drug or pill with a friend not knowing it has fentanyl in it. Under the bill, any delivery of the drug, including sharing in social settings, could make someone eligible for life in prison. Fentanyl is a potent synthetic opioid that is often pressed to look like prescription opioids or mixed with the other drugs being sold illicitly. We'll now go to the section called Overheard in the News, which is quotes from different news stories throughout the last week. The first one is from Iowa House Education Committee Chair Skylar Wheeler, who is a Republican from Hull, about a House bill that would reorganize the state's AEA agencies. The bill would keep Iowa's AEAs as the sole provider of special education support in the state and direct state funding for special education to the school districts. And he said, "One thing was true throughout all of this. Everybody agreed that there were areas to improve and that we could make changes." And then the next quote is from Sioux City School Board member Dan Greenwell on the potential cost savings of having the district set up its own special education, media, and professional development services. "If it were a couple thousand dollars, I would probably say, nah, don't worry about it. But $2 to $3 million is something we should probably look at in the future." Michaela Cagle is the next quote, who's a USD freshman major who is enrolled in a course on football officiating. And she says, "It's interesting to see how much goes into officiating and how much you have to retain to successfully officiate." And then a quote from Sioux City Superintendent Rod Erlingwine on the potential loss of the Air Force Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps due to a lack of military instructors. "We want to continue the program, but right now we don't have instructors to do so." The next one is from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on the passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Under the bill, state and local government shall not substantially burden someone's exercise of religion unless it is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and must be narrowly tailored in the least restrictive means of pursuing that interest. And she said, 23 states around the country with both Republican and Democrat governors have passed similar laws. Now it's Iowa's turn. And, a quote from Representative Eleanor Levin, who is a Democrat from Iowa, on about the passage of that religious freedom bill. Critics say the bill will give legal cover to discriminate against LGBTQ Iowans and others. And she said, although the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was originally intended to protect religious liberty, it has been misused to cause harm, to discriminate, and to deny people health care. And our last one is from Lance Morgan, president and CEO of Ho-Chunk, Inc., and the chair of the board of directors of the Siouxland Initiative on the tri-state area, retaining its top economic growth ranking in Site Selection magazine. And he said, the Siouxland region is proud to continue to perform so well in these annual national rankings. We do not take this recognition for granted, and we will take this opportunity to actively promote the continued diversification of the businesses that contribute to our region's vitality and success. We'll now move to a weekly column called Five Questions With. And today the subject is Sunrise, Anna Heller on the upcoming senior prom. Anna Heller is ready to dance the winter blues away, even if she has to wear a gown that dates back to the Reagan administration. The development director of Sunrise Retirement Community said with a laugh, yes, I am currently scoping out area thrift stores for a 19-era prom dresses. I'll have an 80s hairdo and the 80s gown. That's because the Sunrise community Retirement Community will be hosting its first ever Dancing Away the Winter Blues Sunrise Senior Prom at 6 p.m. Friday at the Point at Sunrise at 36 Eastview Drive. Yes, you read that correctly. The next benefit of the Sunrise Foundation is, literally, a senior prom for real-life senior citizens. Founded in 1959, Sunrise Retirement Community is Siouxland's only community-based nonprofit senior living community, providing for the entire care spectrum. This fundraiser supports the future of Sunrise and some of the major needs on its campus. The Journal spoke with Heller recently about the event. Questions and answers have been edited for style and clarity. The first question, a senior prom for senior citizens sounds like a fun idea. Who came up with it? And they answer, I am blessed with a very imaginative board who always generates exciting fundraising ideas. Our Sunrise Senior Prom will be just like the ones our residents experienced back in high school, complete with photo booths, plenty of dancing, and a live rock and roll band. You have Gary and Danny's show providing the entertainment, right? Yes, and they are terrific. Whether you plan on dancing the night away or if you're just swaying with the music, Gary and Danny always put on a good show. And the next question is, I bet plenty of residents will be sharing their own memories of past senior proms. And she says, absolutely. Whether it is their own senior prom or perhaps getting their own children ready for prom, it can be a magical time. Who knows? Maybe a resident might have missed their own senior prom from back in the day. This will be their time to experience it. Better late than never, I guess. What else can people experience at the Dancing Away the Winter Blues Sunrise Senior Prom? Well, we do advertise that we'll have plenty of heavy hors d'oeuvres. That usually gets a good reaction. Plus, it will be a nice time to experience our beautiful Point at Sunrise on a beautiful night in March. This reminds me, would you like to share your own senior prom story? Mine was actually a lot of fun. I grew up in the small town of Griswold, Iowa. Instead of having dinner in a fancy restaurant, we met at the local drive-in. Here we were in our prom dresses, drinking milkshakes and eating cheeseburgers. And this is the Dancing Away the Winter Blues Sunrise Senior Prom at 6 p.m. Friday at the Point at Sunrise at 36 Eastview Drive in Sioux City. Lawsuit against East Sac Schools moved to federal court. A negligence lawsuit filed against the East Sac County School District by the mother of a teenage boy who had a sexual relationship with a high school teacher will be heard in federal court rather than Sac County. Because the suit involves allegations of U.S. constitutional rights violation, the case may be removed to federal court, Sioux City lawyer Douglas Phillips, who is representing the school district, said in a notice of removal filed Monday in U.S. District Court in Sioux City. The federal court also may have jurisdiction over state law-related claims. The boy's mother sued the school district, former Superintendent Jeffrey Cruz and former Principal Kevin Litterer, in Sac County District Court in February. She said they failed to adequately supervise special education teacher Stephanie Kelsey and investigate rumors of her affair with the mother's teenage son. That lack of action denied the mother and son their constitutional equal protection rights, according to the lawsuit. According to the lawsuit, Kelsey sent numerous nude photos to the boy and had sex with him regularly from December 2021 until March 4, 2022, when the boy was a freshman and ages 14 and 15. The mother said in the lawsuit that administrators did not search for her son when he was reported as absent from classes. During some of his absences, he was in Kelsey's classroom, where they sometimes had sex behind locked doors. The lawsuit said at least two parents called school officials to report rumors of the sexual relationship and the nude photos, but no investigation was done. Cruz and Litterer spoke to Kelsey in January or February of 2022 about the rumors, which she denied. The boy was never interviewed and his mother was not contacted. The mother contacted the Sac County Sheriff's Office after receiving copies of text messages her son had sent to another teen that indicated he had been having sex with Kelsey. Kelsey was arrested 2 days later. Kelsey, now 36, later pleaded guilty to single counts of third-degree sexual abuse and sexual exploitation by a school employee and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. The mother and her son are seeking damages for emotional pain and anguish, humiliation, embarrassment, anxiety, and loss of enjoyment of life and incurred medical and counseling costs. Denison man gets 10 years prison on gun charge. A Denison, Iowa man has been sentenced to federal prison for illegally possessing a gun. Kevin DeWolf, 34, pleaded guilty in September in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to possession of a firearm by a felon. He was sentenced Thursday to 10 years in prison to be followed by 3 years of supervised release. There is no parole in the federal system. DeWolf was found in possession of the firearm in November 2022. Because of prior felony convictions, he was prohibited from possessing firearms. Police arrest suspect in Sioux City stabbing. A suspect in a February stabbing in downtown Sioux City has been arrested. The stabbing was reported at approximately 9:35 p.m. February 5th in the 500 block of 9th Street. The victim told police he was attacked by two men who were going through his pockets, and he has sustained a head injury and a stab wound in the lower right arm that caused a large amount of blood loss. According to court documents, police obtained video footage of the assault, and the victim, who lives at the warming shelter, pointed out his assailant to security there. On Friday, police officers located Darfus Stewart, who denied knowing the victim. When shown pictures of himself with the victim, Stewart said he was present at the assault and the victim had attempted to stab him. Stewart told police the victim walked away, but he caught up with him and fought with him, court documents said. Stewart, 23, of Sioux City, was booked into the Woodbury County Jail on one count of willful injury, a Class D felony. His bond was set at $10,000. In Nebraska legislative news, Pillen vetoes bill to allow needle distribution. Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen issued his first veto of the year Monday, sending back to the legislature a bill that would allow local jurisdictions to distribute hypodermic needles to drug users to reduce the spread of infectious disease. The legislature had given the bill third-round approval on a 30-7 vote last week, signaling strong bipartisan support for the proposal introduced by Senator Megan Hunt of Omaha. The bill, LB 307, would let public health providers set up needle distribution programs with approval from cities or other jurisdictions. Nebraska would be one of the last states to legalize such programs if the legislature overrides Pillen's veto, which would take 30 votes, the same amount the bill garnered the last time the body considered it Thursday, when two senators who had supported the bill in prior votes were absent. Still, Pillen exercised his veto power to reject the bill, calling it problematic in a news release on Monday. As written, it exposes our kids to increased dangers by allowing them to participate in needle exchange programs and does nothing to enhance the safety of our communities, Pillen wrote. There is also evidence that these programs lead to enhanced drug use and does not result in significant reductions in the transmission of communicable diseases. Pillen's rationale runs counter to the conclusions of communicable disease and public safety experts. Nearly 30 years of research shows that comprehensive syringe service programs are safe, effective, save money, and do not increase illegal drug use or crime, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Such programs also play an important role in reducing the transmission of infections, including viral hepatitis and HIV, among others, according to the CDC. Hunt introduced the bill as Nebraska's HIV infection rate is rising while the nationwide rate is falling, she said, amid floor debate earlier this month, citing a 26% increase in infections recorded in 2021. This victory is a testament to our commitment to creating a healthier and safer Nebraska, Hunt said in a social media post last week, after her bill received final round approval in the legislature. By empowering local jurisdictions to address rising HIV rates and fentanyl-related incidents, LB 307 brings us one step closer to a Nebraska where everyone can thrive. Though some conservative senators ultimately opposed the bill, others who were initially hesitant were swayed by provisions allowing local control of the programs and a letter of support from Douglas County Sheriff Aaron Hansen, who called for lawmakers to take an umbrella approach to reducing addiction. It's unclear when the legislature may take up a motion to override Pillen's veto. Iowa contracts for special education services. The state will contract with a suburban Des Moines company to provide guidance to Iowa families with special education students, the State Education Department announced on Monday. The Iowa Department of Education said it will allocate $1 million for the first year of the program to Ask Resource Center in Johnston. The contract period started March 1st, according to a news release from the Education Department. The funding will come from the State Education Department's federal funding via the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is dedicated to special education services for ages 3 to 21, according to the news release. Previously, the state contracted with Iowa's area education agencies on a similar program. The state in January informed AEA leaders that it will no longer contract with the agencies on what was called the Family Educator Partners Program, under which AEA coordinators at no cost to families provided support, information, and resources to families and educators about special education services that are available to Iowa students with disabilities and their families. The state allocated $1.3 million for that program during the most recent state budget year from that same federal funding source, according to Iowa Department of Education spokeswoman. A spokesman for Governor Kim Brundle said last week that the state is separating from the AEAs on the Family Educator Partners Program because of conflicts of interest. The program workers are also AEA employees. And because of what he said were inconsistencies in support provided and confusion over roles and responsibilities as identified in a 2014 report. The new program through Ask Resource Center will provide access to family support specialists and other professionals who will help families understand their rights in accessing what their child needs to be successful in and outside of the classroom, the news release said. Under the new program, according to the State Education Department, Ask Resource Center will have 18 full-time equivalent staff, including a family support supervisor, lead family support specialist, 9 full-time family support specialists, and additional part-time professionals who will provide one-on-one support to families of students with disabilities. Services provided will, according to the state, include helping families understand program requirements and case law, preparing families for meetings with their child's individual education program team, helping IEP meetings with families to help them articulate concerns, and make requests and supporting families in navigating through disputes with schools. The Department of Education remains committed to ensuring all families of children with disabilities consistently receive timely, high-quality resources and supports that are responsive to their needs, Iowa Department of Education Director Mackenzie Snow said in a statement. In partnership with Ask Resource Center, families across Iowa will have the support of family specialists, family mentors, and experts focused on accessibility and post-secondary transitions as they advocate for their children with disabilities. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituaries. Joan E. McDermott, 89, of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, February 17th, at Well Life Assisted Living in Elk Point. Mass of Christian burial will be Saturday, March 9th, 2024, at 10 a.m. at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Sioux City, with Father Tom McDermott officiating. Burial will take place at Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City beside her husband, Harold. Rosary and visitation will be from 9 to 10 a.m. on Saturday, all at the church. Joan was born September 5, 1934, in Sioux City, the daughter of Merritt and Esther Carlson. She was the youngest of four children. She attended Sioux City schools. In her youth years, she was a champion baton twirler. She graduated from Central High School, where she was a majorette leader in 1952. She continued her further education by attending Wayne State College in Nebraska, where she met her future husband, Harold Mick McDermott, on December 29, 1956, in Sioux City. To this union, four children were born: Mary, Mike, Mark, and Matt. They spent many years living in Sioux City. She taught school in Sioux City at Riverside High and North High. She enjoyed many years at the lake home with her husband and family in Spirit Lake. Harold passed away on November 18, 2016. In 2021, she moved to Elk Point and lived at Well Life Assisted Living until her passing. She was a devoted wife, mother, and grandmother. Cobra Funeral Home of Elk Point has been entrusted with the services. Gerald E. Clark, 79, formerly of Battle Creek and originally of Quimby, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, February 17th at St. Elizabeth Hospital in Beaumont, Texas. Memorial services will be held on Saturday, March 9th at 11 a.m. at the Boothie Funeral Home in Cherokee. Pastor Mike Agnew will officiate. Burial will be in the Oak Hill Cemetery at Cherokee. Visitation will be held on Saturday, March 9th from 10 a.m. until the service time at Boothie Funeral Home in Cherokee. The Boothie Funeral Home of Cherokee is assisting the family with arrangements. Gerald E. Clark was born December 19, 1944 in Cherokee. He was the youngest of six siblings of George Clark and Dola Wymore Clark. He was raised on an acreage near Quimby and graduated from Quimby High School. After high school, he moved to Storm Lake, where he met Carol Sue Smith. The two were united in marriage on April 15, 1967 in Battle Creek. Gerald and Carol had two sons, Jay and David, and moved to Hampton and Davenport before residing in Battle Creek. He worked as an over-the-road truck driver for many years before going to work at GOMACO Corps as a field service technician. While working at GOMACO, he traveled all over the world diagnosing and repairing paving equipment. After leaving GOMACO, he went to work repairing construction equipment in the field for several contractors and distributors, including Irving F. Jensen, Cedar Valley Corps, RMS, and DMI. After Jerry's retirement, he spent much of his time fishing for walleye at Lake Francis Case at his summer residence near Platte, South Dakota, with his son David. In the fall, he would pack up and move to his winter residence near Brooklyn, Texas, to spend time with friends and then move back to South Dakota each spring. Lois Viola Beckwith Bowman, 74, of South Sioux City, died Thursday, February 29th at her residence surrounded by family. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, March 7th at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Visitation with the family will be 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Burial will be at Dakota City Cemetery. Lois was born August 18, 1949, in Delta, Colorado, with the daughter of Doris and Jack Beckwith. She married Kenneth Almond Bowman on March 6, 1985. To this union, they had one daughter, Tina. Lois retired in 2018 from Alorica. She was a great friend to everyone that crossed her path. She enjoyed being with her family and granddaughters. The family would like to thank Hospice of Siouxland for their special care of Lois. Charles John Chuck Papa Schmidt, 84, of Sioux City, passed away on Sunday, March 3rd at a local nursing facility. Funeral services will be 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 6th at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, with Reverend Scott Squires officiating. Visitation with the family present will begin at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Chuck was born on May 10, 1939 in Hospice, Iowa, to Arnold and Florence Schmidt, and the last name is spelled S-C-H-M-I-T-H. The family lived in Paulina, Iowa during his early childhood, moved to Sioux City in 1953, where Chuck graduated from East High School with the class of 1959. He went on to continue his education and received his degree from Morningside College in Business Administration. Chuck worked for a couple of years at a clothing store in downtown Sioux City before working at Needham Packing Company for 9 years. He then joined the crew at IBP and worked there for 24 years. He worked for Peterson Farms for 10 years, and he loved the cattle business and visiting with people. Chuck married Martha Marty in 1978, combining two families. He was an avid golfer, enjoyed playing cards, and was a sports enthusiast. He loved cheering on the Nebraska Cornhuskers, the Briarcliff Volleyball, and loved watching and encouraging his grandchildren in various sports. Mark A. Winkle, 66, of Elkhorn, formerly of Sioux City, passed away February 29th, preceded in death by his wife Dawn, parents David and Carol, brothers and sister-in-law David and Paul, Paula and Dick Winkle. Memorial service will be held at Wychmuth Funeral Home, Elkhorn, Nebraska at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 6, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service, followed by military honors. Private interment. Memorials may be made to the family. June Bowers, 93, of Storm Lake, died Thursday, January 23rd. Services will be March 9, 2024 at 1 p.m. at Lakeside Presbyterian Church in Storm Lake. Burial will be in the Storm Lake Cemetery. Visitation will be March 8th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Fraske and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. That concludes the obituaries for today. Our next article is Nebraska's Empty Churches Are Becoming Apartments or Museums. The kitchen table isn't far from the altar in Kathy and Tim Johnson's home. A comfortable recliner and cozy couch share the living room with a wooden pew. Stained glass windows cast colorful shadows across their bedroom. Other people walk in and they stop and they just go, "Wow," Kathy Johnson said. "We just kind of forget that it was a church." After more than a century of worship, Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Benedict, Nebraska, closed its doors in January 2020. 7 months later, the Johnsons bought it. This house of worship turned home is one of a number of Nebraska churches that, amid rising costs and falling attendance, have found second lives filling gaps in their local communities. Churches are becoming apartments, community centers, and places to preserve history and foster the arts. In early February, the Lincoln City Council signed off on a proposal to turn the former Southminster Methodist Church into offices and apartments. Cadre Architecture and Design is set to buy the church for $350,000 after New Visions United Methodist Church decided to merge into one building and sell their two remaining properties in Lincoln. A Baptist congregation bought the first, while the latter, awaiting a religious buyer, received only secular offers. Other proposals included a gym and an art gallery. "We were focused on selling the buildings to other churches, but it doesn't have to be that way," New Visions board chair Beth Baldwin said. New Visions had a front row seat to what Rick Reinhardt calls the great mismatch. Aged congregations no longer have the resources or numbers to fill and maintain large and in some cases deteriorating buildings, said Reinhardt, an urban planner and consultant who spent 4 years assessing United Methodist Church properties across the United States. He points to four factors that have contributed to the mismatch: declining membership, rising property expenses, virtual live stream options, and COVID-19. "There was hope that someday we would get back to being three separate churches," said Reverend Doyle Burbank Williams, pastor at New Visions. "But it was just became so obvious that something needed to be done." Americans' participation in organized religion has declined in recent decades, multiple surveys have shown. A study by the Public Religion Research Institute found a combined 56% of respondents in 2022 said they either seldom or never attend religious services, up from 43% in 2013. That tracks with research by the Hartford Institute for Religion Research that found median attendance at weekly worship services decreased from 137 attendees in 2000 to 65 attendees in 2020. the Omaha Archdiocese, which spans from Omaha to Sioux City, told the Flatwater Free Press that only 25% of Catholics in Northeast Nebraska attend Sunday Mass, and there's been a 42% decline in Mass attendance since 2003. 15 churches in the Archdiocese have closed since 2000. The United Methodist Church Great Plains Conference, which includes Nebraska and Kansas, has seen 81 churches close since 2014. Three other Christian religious authorities in Nebraska contacted by the Flatwater Free Press either did not respond or said they did not keep records of closures to confidently report. Part of the mismatch, Reinhardt said, lies in the fact that many churches were constructed at a time when they needed to be within walking distance of parishioners. He said, well, not only do we have motorized vehicles, now we have the internet. So if I want to watch the Archbishop of Canterbury service in London, all I have to do is click the mouse. Churches are also expensive to operate. The International Facility Management Association estimates that it costs $7 to $10 per square foot annually to run a church. Rising maintenance costs factored into the decision to sell the First Baptist Church in Wayne in 2021, according to Matt Lay. Lay bought the property for $175,000 after seeing the listing on Facebook. At one point, he said, the congregation was considering selling the church windows, demolishing the building, and selling the lot. He thought that would be a mistake. You cannot build that building the way it is now for less than $4 million, he said. He renovated the church into six apartment units, which now rent for between $1,000 and $2,000 a month. I really just wanted to save one of the most beautiful buildings in town and provide different housing options. Nebraska has not been immune from a nationwide housing shortage. A 2022 report by the Strategic Housing Council of Nebraska found a statewide shortage of 32,230 rental units for extremely low-income households. The report noted the shortage extends to housing at all price points across the state. Kathy and Tim Johnson sold their home in York and moved into the former church in Benedict out of a desire to live closer to family without the burden of a mortgage. They bought and renovated the 5,100-square-foot church for less than $100,000, most of which was used to build a kitchen, add plumbing upstairs, and update the wiring. Overall, the structure was basically sound as far as not needing any repairs, Tim Johnson said. The Johnsons were initially concerned about the utility bills, but they've turned out to be manageable. If you don't want to be in debt, go buy a church in a small town, said Kathy Johnson, a former member of the church she now lives in. While housing is a common use for a church's second act, it's not the only one. The First Presbyterian Church in Madison was sold for $5,000 and turned into a nonprofit arts center in 2007. The former Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Snyder was converted into a museum in 2018, and the Seward Chamber of Commerce bought and repurposed a local Presbyterian church to become the Old Glory Theater in 2013. In Pilger, St. Peter's Lutheran Church managed to survive a pair of devastating tornadoes in 2014, but it ultimately could not survive falling attendance and a lack of volunteers, said Gene Willers, a former member of St. Peter's. The church closed in January 2023, and the congregation donated the building to the Stanton County Historical Society, which now runs a museum out of the former church. With only one Lutheran church remaining in town, Willer said most people drive to Norfolk or Wisner to attend religious service. It's just a hard adjustment. In the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod District that covers all of Nebraska, minus the Panhandle, 35 churches have closed or disbanded since 2000. When the Reverend Scott Allen Johnson became bishop of the Nebraska Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America 18 months ago, one church was in the process of closing. Another went through from start to finish, and a third has begun. Closures can be emotional experiences, especially for families who have deep connections to a church, said Reverend Johnson, who noted that some properties can also include a cemetery. There has not been any pushback, but is there grief? Yes, he said. Some Nebraska churches are choosing to restructure the congregations rather than sell or donate their properties. In 2022, the Omaha Archbishop grouped 134 Catholic churches into 33 families across eastern Nebraska. The change allows parishes to better coordinate resources that can address declining attendance, population changes, and shifting cultural attitudes, said Riley Johnson, Omaha Archdiocese Communications Director. No parishes have made a decision to merge or close since the restructure. Johnson said the Archdiocese wants to shift its attention from maintaining buildings to the mission that we are all called as Christians to carry on, which is to go out and bring the hope of the gospel to our neighbors. We'll now move to some sports news. We'll start with some basketball college. Dort women, Morningside men reach GPAC title games. The Dort women and the Morningside men advance to the title games for the GPAC basketball tournaments. Morningside plays at Hastings for the men's championship, while Dort hosts Concordia in the women's finals in Sioux Center Tuesday night. Top-seeded Dort reached the finals after beating number 5 seed Dakota Wesleyan at home Saturday. Number 2 seed Concordia moved on after outlasting number 3 seed Briar Cliff in Seward. Morningside advanced after knocking off top seed Northwestern in Orange City Saturday, and number 2 seed Hastings won at home over number 3 seed Concordia. The winner of the Morningside-Hastings game secured the GPAC's second automatic bid to the NAIA Men's Basketball National Tournament. The first went to Northwestern, which won a 3-way tiebreaker for the regular season automatic bid. The loser of the Hastings-Morningside game likely will be an at-large selection for the 64-team field. Dort secured an automatic bid to the NAIA Women's National Tournament as the regular season GPAC champion. Concordia also will receive an automatic bid as either the postseason champion or the runner-up. In quarterfinal GPAC women's games, Dort beat number 8 seed Doan, while Concordia outdistanced number 7 Morningside. Dakota Wesleyan knocked off number 4 Northwestern, while Briar Cliff beat number 6 Jamestown. In the men's quarterfinals, Northwestern beat Dakota Wesleyan, Morningside raced number 5 Jamestown, Concordia nipped at number 6 Dort, and Hastings defeated number 7 Briar Cliff. The final field and bracket for the NAIA men's and women's tournaments will be announced at 7 p.m. Thursday on the NAIA YouTube channel. The NAIA last week announced Orange City Northwestern and Sioux City Morningside will be 2 of the 16 sites for the first and second round men's tournament games, March 15th to 16th. Sioux Center will be 1 of the 16 sites for the first and second round women's games. The 16 teams that emerged from the women's opening rounds will advance to the Women's National Championship March 21st through 26th at the Tyson Events Center in Sioux City. The 16 winners from the men's opening rounds will move on to the Men's National Championship March 21st to 26th at Municipal Auditorium in Kansas City, Missouri. And now, hockey story. Metros finished 3rd at state. After sustaining an upset loss in the semifinals, the Sioux City Metros rebounded to win the third-place consolation game Sunday in the Midwest High School Hockey League's postseason tournament. The Metros, the regular season champion, entered the tournament in West Des Moines as the top seed. After shutting out number 8 seed Ames in the quarterfinals Friday, the Metros dropped a 5-1 decision to number 4 seed Kansas City in the semi-Saturday. The Jets jumped out to a 3-0 lead in the first period and added single goals in the second and third period. Grant Harder scored the Metros' lone goal on a power play in the second period. In the third-place game Sunday, Sioux City blasted Waterloo 9-1 as 7 different Metros scored goals. Leading scorer Nate Solma and Tegan Dolman had 2 each, and Carson Fitch, Charlie Egdort, Ryan Hedquist, Blaze Bauer, Hunter Ector had 1 apiece. Kansas City won the varsity tournament, shutting out Des Moines Oak Leafs 3-0 in the final. In the junior varsity tournament, Sioux City beat the Des Moines Capitals 4-3 Sunday to place 3rd. The Metros JV lost to Waterloo 4-3 in the semifinal Saturday. It was the first time the JV squad had qualified for the state tournament since 2015. The Metros varsity was the defending state champions. The team, comprised of players from several schools in the Sioux City area, won a team record 28 regular season games this season, finishing a point ahead of second-place Des Moines Oak Leafs. As the top regular season team in Iowa, the Metros automatically qualified for the USA Hockey National High School Division II Championships March 20-24 in Westchester, Pennsylvania. It will be Sioux City's first appearance at the Nationals since the Metros won the tournament in 2018. And we'll now move to the Dear Abby column. Our first letter. My husband speaks to his mother every morning. For the past couple of months, her health has been failing, and she spends most of her days in the hospital, having an extremely tough time. Hearing his mom suffer daily is affecting my husband's mental health. It sets the tone for the whole day, and I spend my mornings trying to cheer him up. How do I tell him these daily conversations with his mother are starting to affect my mornings? Even the dog has begun showing signs of depression. Would I be selfish to suggest he needs to talk to her at a different time or maybe on fewer days? Signed, Bystander in California. And Abby's response. Your husband may not have much longer to talk with his very ill mother, so I don't recommend you approach the subject that way. What I do suggest is that you tell your husband how much you love him, that you can see and feel his distress over her condition. Then suggest he talk with a mental health professional who can help him work this through, because you can see how much pain this is causing him. Then cross your fingers and hope he will realize how much he needs it. Next letter. Dear Abby, I am writing this in the hope that the man of my dreams reads it. I don't know how to approach him. He's getting ready to retire, and I have fallen deeply in love with him as the years have gone by. He's a little on the chubby side, as am I, but his personality has always amused me. Sometimes he poses sexy as a joke and will often show his belly button. I find him staring at me out of the corner of his eye most days. Please help me before it's too late. I'm running out of time. Signed, his dream guy in Tennessee. And the response. You stated that your dream man is getting ready to retire. I can't think of a better reason for a celebration. Suggest the two of you go out for a drink or dinner after work so you can toast his upcoming retirement. Then cross your fingers that he agrees. It could be the start of something beautiful. Dear Abby, my husband suffered a stroke 8 years ago. Everyone thinks he's fine physically and mentally, except those closest to him. We know his brain does not function the same. Example, when he went to fill out a job application, he asked me whose name should he put in the applicant field. He occasionally has a short temper, but in recent months he has grown verbally abusive to the point that I'm considering divorcing him. Anything can set him off, and there is no correct reaction from me. I am going to seek counseling. Any other advice for me? Signed, ready to leave in Delaware. And the response. I do have one other bit of advice. You state that everyone thinks your husband is fine physically and mentally. Are you including his doctors in that statement? Forgetting to put one's own name on a job application and having a recent personality change could be signs of dementia. You should let them know you are worried so he can be evaluated. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 5th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now, researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.